Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Advocacy Prime. I am your host here, Michael Aragone, and I welcome you back to this amazing podcast platform that advocates for people with disabilities, by people with disabilities, and other stakeholders alike. I have exciting news for you. We are now on YouTube, so you are able to see this live interview up on YouTube with my somewhat okay camera editing skills, but hey, it's gonna be a work in progress, all right? And we have a fantastic guest. His name is John Bellinger, and he is an advocate for his son, Christopher, with autism. Now, I got a little small disclaimer. Some of the audio did cut off at the end, so I will not be including about 15 minutes of the ending, but I will be providing a little bit of an update. But today, John, he brings us through how he has had his highs and his extreme lows that has brought him to be this amazing advocate that he is, and how he has found a community. Let's give it up for John Bellinger. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Advocacy Prime, our 8th podcast episode here. And I am having the absolute pleasure right now of, first of all, having our very first video podcast, which I'm very excited about. And I get to share it with a very, very special guest, John Bellinger. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing great, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you coming over here, into my humble abode as we dive into the amazingness of advocacy. And so, I came across you listening to I kind of saw you on Facebook, and then I was able to listen to a podcast that you're on, and it is called Dad to Dad. How was that experience for you?
It was great. That actually is through an organization that I work with called Special Fathers Network. There's a great guy, David Hirsch, who's actually a senior vice president of UBS Financial downtown. He's worked with a variety of advocacy groups for dads over the years. And a couple of years ago, he really turned his focus to special needs dads. So he started the Special Fathers Network as an outreach, which is a mentorship program, and then a series of podcasts with special needs dads for special needs dads. So I got to be lucky number 65 there. But if you look at the list, it's pretty impressive. You got some local celebrities on there and that type of thing. A lot of guys who are special needs dads you wouldn't expect. So it was very cool to, you know, be part of that group.
Yeah. Speaking of special needs dads, yeah, you are a... You're a father, and you are an advocate for your son, Christopher. And I absolutely love how you talk about him. I think it's really cool. And, you know, you guys have a very special connection. And so John is an advocate for his son with autism, and he is nonverbal. And John has had, you know, the history. He was a former elementary teacher for how many years?
17,
that is very cool. He's got his bachelor's and he's got his master's in education, and was a teacher and was a private school director. That is so cool. And you are also, when do you stop, John? You're doing a lot here. You are a public speaker for a key ministry, okay? Speaker at their yearly conference in Cleveland. For Inclusion Fusion. You're also a regular blog contributor there. That's pretty cool. And you just came back from speaking. We just talked about this before we started, but where'd you just come from speaking?
Lovely Overland Park, Kansas. So right next to Kansas City. And I was there with an organization called SOAR, S-O-A-R, Special Needs Disability Ministry. And they also do a yearly conference there called Wonderfully Made. So I spoke and did a couple things there as well.
Did you drive out there or you fly out there?
I flew out there. It's a little bit past my capacity to drive. I do drive to Cleveland, but the Kansas City, I fly, and which is also kind of a joke because that's about like a 50-minute flight, so I'm kind of like on and off and whatever. But the last this last week when I got in late on Wednesday night, it was a late flight because I had to work, and I got to the rental car place at 11:30, and because I refused to pay for an extra day to just drive a half an hour, I said, no, I'll wait till midnight. So I waited until midnight, got to the hotel about 1, and, you know, a lot of coffee and a few hours sleep, and I was still good to go. So
yeah. And that adrenaline probably helps you get up there and speak too in front of all those people.
Totally.
You know, and your passion. So You know, you have a really interesting background. It's very diverse, and you know, we could see it go from the Catholic, religious background, and then we are, when we look at the core of it here, you are a father advocate, and research shows us that fathers are, you know, and particularly males, are less involved in the lives of their child with special needs. And so, you know, you were just also telling me right before this is that you were like the only father at on some sort of board, or like one of the only fathers on the panel speaking.
Yeah, so one of the things I did when I went out there was I did a breakout session, and I also spoke on a parent panel. And the parent panel was all moms, and I was only dad. Now, I think that was intentional on the organizer's part, because generally speaking, you usually hear from the moms, but he did want to make sure dad was represented. And I wasn't the only special needs dad at the conference in terms of a speaker or an attendee. But you do notice at this one and others, as I'm sure you have as well, that the majority are usually the moms, which is fine, because moms are wonderful advocates for the kids. And truthfully, you know, our mama bears, especially our autism mama bears, as I like to call them, and my wife specifically, are great. But we need the dads. We need the dads to be active and engaged. And, you know, I don't do this because I'm trying to necessarily get famous or, you know, some kind of weird attention or anything. It's because I know how hard this is. And I know how much I benefited from guys speaking into my life, whether they were special needs dads or not, as a matter of fact, and then kind of giving that back in whatever way I can to kind of be a guide, a helper, roadmap, whatever you want to call it, to really show dads they need to be involved. It's not a matter of can, they need to be involved, but to kind of show them how, and also as a reminder that they can't do it alone. Yeah. You know, you need help. It's okay to get help. It's okay to ask for help. But then obviously you want that help to be there. And if I can do that, you know, as I always say, if I could do it for one guy and that's all I wind up doing, then that was worth it. So
my question is, I mean, why? Like, it's a fact. There's a higher representation of females out there. And why is it? And why does it go through a male's head that says that, well, I mean, okay, let's just put the divorce rates aside and all that, you know, because that's obviously higher when you have somebody with a child with a disability, that it really does impact the marital life. But like, what is it about males that just do not want to, you know, it's not that they don't want to advocate for their child, but you know, it's a woman's job or something, or like, why do you think so?
So, In a very general sense, I'll tell you what usually happens in a special needs family. And again, this is not all of them, because I know a lot of great special needs dads, and I know a lot of them that are very involved on a variety of levels. But generally, the way that a diagnosis is processed in a marriage is this. Mom is the one that more often than not does the research, digs in, finds the therapist, finds the specialist, gets the doctors, gets the second opinions and all that. And dads are usually involved for a lot of that. But here's the one thing that dads usually wind up doing, and this is something that I can relate to, and also it's the story of a lot of other, you know, couples that I know or I've talked to out there, which is the one thing that the men do is they jump into their work. Because if men know one thing, it's work. That's how we're programmed. So on one level, it's, okay, I don't know how to fix this, but I know if I work really hard, if I work extra hard, at least I'll make enough money so that I can pay for all these things that somehow we need. And I may not understand them, but if my wife says this is what they need, I'll make the money and there you go. The problem with that, though, and I'll speak to it on a couple of levels. The problem, first of all, is that just working harder doesn't fix everything, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe there is more income for more stuff. But the problem with being a special needs parent is that any problems that you already have are, as I like to say, exacerbated, okay? Your marriage is put under more stress. Your family life, the home environment, all those little cracks that you might have had, you know, going forward in terms of your relationship, all of those just open up and get exposed even more. And so if there were already issues, or maybe sometimes there's new issues or both, that all just gets put in a pressure cooker. And so just working more doesn't necessarily help it in the long run. And in my case, personally, and I'm very transparent about this as well, even if that was my choice to do, and at one point I very much believe that it was, I'd still be in a lot of trouble, because quite honestly, I've never been the breadwinner in my family. My wife has always consistently made more money than me. And I'm not ashamed of that. It's not like I haven't worked or made money. But if I put my value in, I'm going to work hard and I'm going to make most of the money or all the money, that wouldn't have even been me anyway. So then what is my value? What purpose do I serve? And for me, that was a real struggle. It took me several years to kind of figure that out. And then to really define, okay, what are my gifts? What do I do? And what you really have to come back down to is being a dad isn't defined by your work or your career, just like it doesn't define you as a person.
Yeah.
But your level of involvement with your child, with your family, and all of the different ways you can give back, whatever that look like, that's your value. And no amount of work or no type of work will ever truly give that to you.
Yeah. It's crazy how, you know, society that we've all of a sudden established ourselves is that, all right, we're the male, that, okay, we need to go to work, we need to do that, and then let's just let, you know, our counterpart, our wife, we're going to go ahead and, you know, she's going to do it because she has that motherly connection, that chemical connection that we will, that biological connection that we'll never be able to fully understand, right? Like, you know, I don't have any kids or anything like that, so I'm just talking anecdotally here, but like, you know, it just, you know, mothers have that stronger connection to their child biologically, right? You know, and so like, I wonder if that's part of it too. Like, you know, is that's what assumed where like, you know, they're going to literally do anything. And not saying that you wouldn't do anything for Christopher, you know, like, but it just really intrigues me that is our, you know, perception in life, is that we're the father. All my values are is that I need to be that fatherly figure that brings home the money, is that breadwinner, and supports my family and kind of lets those, you know, those issues get handled by mom. So is that a pretty big common theme though that you do when you talk to a good basis of fathers, and what you're doing is actually extremely important, and it's extremely well needed, because you know why? I find out that, you know, with some of my students, they don't have a father figure in their family. Like, we'll see a lack of skills and a lack of and actually an increase of behavior. And it's just really important to have that foundation of that father who is very supportive, you know. But not everybody's perfect, and they're able to make that absolute balanced life there, you know. So, you know, what do you think has been like when you're at these conferences or when you're connecting with these other fathers? And I really want to get into that in a bit. What is like the primary connection that you have with the fathers that you meet? Like, what's the one thing in common that all of you can kind of come and agree on? And this is why we're here for our sons or daughters.
I think the one common thing we can all agree on, quite honestly, is how hard this is. Because I think that what happens is most parents, when they first get a diagnosis, are really in a state of shock, quite honestly. And I know we were. And there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of fear. And so what happens is that the knee-jerk reaction, instinctual reaction, kind of like you just very well described it, is you know, mom is going to be the protective one and make sure they can kind of find the solutions or the answers, or at the very least, make sure their child is as taken care of and supported as possible. And dad's going to do what men generally do, which is go out and work and fix it in the ways they know how. Again, that's not defining all dads. And in terms of the dads that I see that are involved on levels that I am, or even more so, you know, they've certainly identified that. And if you listen to their stories, they're not telling you that they had it figured out in the beginning either. All of their stories are stories of struggle and of loss. And in some cases, extreme challenges medically, with their kids. And in some cases, in terms of some of the dads I know, and specifically even with the guy who was the organizer of the conference that I just came from, you know, his special needs child passed away and he's still doing this, you know, in honor and memory of him. So we're bonded by the struggle. The difference is this: how do you embrace the struggle, you know, or do you embrace it at all? Right. Do you just say, you know what, I'm not having anything to do with that? Or do you say, you know what, this is my family, and you know what, I'm just going to plow ahead and you know, we're going to figure it out. And you know, there's also a piece there, obviously, in terms of men getting connected with feelings and the things that make them uncomfortable and stuff. And I think not all guys are wired that way. For some men, you know, I would say for myself, it's always been kind of natural. That doesn't make it easier necessarily, because
if anything, it makes it harder.
Yeah, right. Because what you find out is the deeper, you know, it's the layers of the onion thing. The deeper you go, the more sticky it gets and smelly and all that. And yeah, it's like, do I really want to keep going here?
Right.
But something kind of pushes you through that and says, okay, I'm doing this for my kids, I'm doing this for my family, one way or another, we're going to make this work, whatever that looks like. And also tied there too is this whole thing of expectations, right?
Yeah.
Because as a parent, you have expectations that, wow, my kids are going to be perfectly healthy and fine and life's going to be great.
Go to college, all that, girlfriend, boyfriend, yeah.
The whole nine yards. And then what does it look like for you as a parent? Well, now that's different. And you really have to redefine your whole life. And not everyone, unfortunately, is in a place where they're willing to take all of that on. And for that, I don't judge or criticize. I really have a great deal of empathy for them because I get it, because I almost lost everything too. And by the grace of God, I didn't, but that's why I do what I do. And I encourage dads to also either seek the help or, you know, be a help to another dad or, you know, in whatever way that looks like.
I think that, you know, what's very admirable about you is that empathy part, right? And that's a piece that not many people, I'm sorry, that people have, but many people don't know how to utilize. It's that we can't go and be critical towards another father for, you know, not showing up to all of their Special Olympic basketball games. You know, everybody is so different. And again, I think that's what, yet we're all the same. You know, I think one of my most, I was in Peru this summer and we were in these catacombs and you look down in there and it's all the bones that were buried from, you know, way back about, 1200 years ago. And I look at the bones, and they're all the same. The skulls are the same. Like, everything, you know. And that what I mean by this is that we are all really, like, you know, we're diverse, but yet we're all human. And that is one thing that I really want to spread, you know, the message about in this podcast, is that people are going to deal with guilt. People are going to deal with grief. People are going to deal with the emotions in complete different ways. And not one way that you deal with it is the right way, right? And I think that it's like people like you who can be empathetic towards that, where you understand that broad range of emotions there, where you're like, all right, you know, this guy is super involved, and then you have this guy who is not. Let me take the good things from this guy, because there's not a lot of, there's not all good things about this guy, but let me take those aspects and bring out the positives in this guy. And then let me take those aspects and help them. You know, I think that's how an empathetic person could be. But then we happen to put ourselves second. And that's something I can empathize with you, you know, and relate to you about. Is there times where, you know, you have put yourself second? And do you ever find yourself still doing that? As an advocate, because again, you're an advocate. You're advocating for somebody else, not yourself.
That's a super deep, profound question. Yeah, it's something that I have had to deal with. But I'll say this: a lot of it had to do with how I also kind of reshaped and redefined what that meant for me. So when we first got our son's diagnosis, or, you know, in the early days, I very much felt second. Now, part of that was intentional, because I was really trying to support the family, support my son, support my wife. But in those early days, I think what made it specifically difficult for me was the fact that my wife is an incredibly organized, intelligent, creative woman who also, once she gets her mind around something, you know, it's almost to the point of obsession, but in a good way. You know, yeah. She went to work and she did that research, and she, you know, found every possible, you know, specialist and person that we could possibly talk to, and organize therapies and put all those things together. And I have her mom, you know, my mother-in-law, who we're very close to, also was very involved and is still involved to a great deal. But what was challenging for me is, I found myself being the man, and as I explained, I wasn't the breadwinner, So it wasn't like people came to me and said, okay, you know, we need you to write a check for this, because that wasn't me. And I also saw these two very powerful, strong-willed type A women who were kind of leading the charge. And I kind of felt, well, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't even intentional on their part, but it was just who they were. And then I had to feel like, okay, what is my role here? Now, the negative impact of that was that I took on a lot of shame. I took on a lot of shame and a lot of self-doubt and self-loathing, because I said, I'm not really providing here. I'm not really providing a solution or whatever. And then when we really got into the thick of our issues a few years later, that really became apparent. How I redefine that, though, is, again, kind of going back to what I said earlier, I learned that, you know what, there is great value in being of service to your family and service to others. And so my number two, as I have friends who are writers and some of the folks that presented at the conference I was at, you know, and again, they talk about from a faith perspective, but they'll say, you know, your plan B was God's plan A, meaning that this wasn't the choice for you, but guess what? It really was the best thing for you, because guess what? Maybe there was a plan for you to be doing this work. You would have never done this if somebody gave this to you. Yeah. If somebody would have told me 10 years ago, dude, your child is going to have autism and it's going to lead you to serve others with this advocacy and this writing and speaking, whatever, I'd been like, what are you talking about?
Right.
You know, because like it wouldn't have made sense. Now it makes perfect sense. But again, I had to get real with who I was. I had to get real with my true value. And I had to understand that, you know what, sometimes the best thing for you is to absolutely put yourself second or put yourself in a role of service. Because then you actually get connected with your passion and your talents and your abilities. And so now I'm saying, look, these are all the things I know I'm good at.
Yeah.
And I enjoy doing them. And not just because I think I'm good at them or they're fun, but because I'm giving back. I'm helping people. I'm helping people who are once like me, especially the guys, the dads, and saying, you know what? I've been there. I get it. Look, I don't have all the answers. I'm not perfect. But you know what? One thing is for sure. You're not going to do it alone. If I'm all you got, that's cool. I'll be all you got, because I know what it was like to not have anybody and then have guys step into my life and how much of a difference that made.
When you talk about that, this is like my plan and you know, God's plan, and that, you know, this is like what I was meant to do. How often have you doubted that? You know, how often have you said there? No, I mean, absolutely not, you know, or, you know, do you ever have moments of weakness where, you know, where you might still kind of doubt that? You're like, wait, like, all right, I'm doing all these wonderful things. I'm helping people. I'm providing, I'm giving back. You know, I'm in a really good place, but what else? Or, you know, what if, right? Like, have you ever kind of had that thought, you know, and I'm just trying to kind of relate to, and again, as we know, I'm not a father yet. No messages out there right now. You know, just trying to connect with those other fathers too that said, okay, well, maybe this is my destiny, but why? You know what I'm saying?
So I wish I would have an answer for that, and I honestly don't. But what I can tell you is, based on my experience and what I've learned, is that you may never get an answer to why you,
yeah.
You know. But here's what you can do. You can take what you've been given, and you can still make it beautiful. You can still do great things with it. You can still be great with what you've been given. Because what you have to remember at the end of the day is this. Your child with special needs is still your child.
Right.
Your child wasn't taken from you. Now, legitimately, if there were medical conditions or an illness or something that caused, you know, the child to pass or something, you know, and then, of course, you absolutely have my sympathy with that. But you know, whatever your child's disability is, if they are with you, that's still a gift.
Yeah.
And you still have a responsibility to be the best parent you can be and own that and be excited for that. And look, I'm not saying it because I am every day, because honestly, I'm not. But I think what I've identified is that, okay, when there's opportunities come into your space for a reason. Okay. I'm not going to understand why my child had special needs exactly, you know, in my case, until I get to the other side,
yeah.
Right? And as close as I can get in this life, I won't fully understand it. But what I do know is this: my child is such an incredible gift. I look at all the wonderful things that he does do, even though he doesn't speak. Just his smile, just his presence, just the way that he plays with you and interacts with you. I mean, that's a gift enough. And so that's what you find. You find those pockets and those little spaces where you can say, wow, this is better than I could have imagined. And then you take that and then you say, okay, well, for guys who are struggling, you know, what can I share about me? You know, I don't, in terms of the things that I write about and speak about, it's just my life.
Yeah.
But incredible things have happened to me that I'm like, I can't explain any other way other than I know that this is what I'm supposed to be doing, because things would not have lined up the way they did, how they did, with the people that I've had the great blessing and honor to come across and meet and interact with. You know, it's just the knowing that I have. And if you're a special needs dad out there, look, I'm not saying that this is going to be you or that you need to do what I'm doing or what we're doing, but you still can have the best life ever, the most rich and fulfilling life that you've ever imagined, but you've got to be willing to embrace it. The good, the bad, the hard days, the good days, all of it.
Yeah, that is super intuitive. That's really neat. I mean, because, you know, fathers and people in general just have to understand that they're not in this alone, and that everybody has their uniqueness and everybody has their gifts and their abilities and things that have been brought to them. And sometimes we question those things, but it's really, and what you've been explaining is that to take those gifts and make them special and really show people that this is a really positive experience. I really do want to talk about Christopher a little bit more, because there's something I really do relate with in terms of like working with people who are nonverbal. Like, I don't know what it is. It's like really hard to explain when like, you know, they're never going to be able to say, you're my favorite teacher, or you do a lot for me, or you help me out. But like there's nonverbal ways that they tell you that. And like, it's, I don't know. It's like this feeling you really can't explain, and it's like that you look forward to, and it's like you try to like do things that will also bring that out for your own selfish benefit too. Like to know that, okay, like, all right, you love me too. You know what I'm saying? Like with your son Christopher, what are some like those breakthrough moments that you have had that where you're like, you know, heart's fluttering, you're all excited, jumping around, you know?
Yeah, and here's the one thing I would say, and I think it's still different for every kid, for sure. But I know in our son's case, the one thing that we really had to understand is that he gets everything that's being said to him. And it's easy to say, well, yeah, he understands, like, okay, yeah, so how do you know? Well, in our case, you know, he uses a communication device. We have an app on his iPad called Touch Chat, which is great.
Nice. Yeah.
And not only do we have, you know, basically like picture schedules and different things on there where, you know, he can answer basic questions about his day or what he wants to eat for dinner, that type of thing. But we also have a letter board on there, and he has the ability to spell out basic words and phrases and sentences. And he has one really good therapist who always, for whatever reason, gets the most out of him. And we'll actually do things like, you know, read stories with him, and he'll answer questions and not just yes, no, but he'll actually spell things out. So we have an awareness that he knows, you know, or, you know, sometimes every once in a while, the random word or phrase will come out and like, did you just say that? Like, you know, he had a first grade teacher who was like, you know, teasing him one day and said something like, hey, Christopher, Mistopher. And, you know, he said, oh, that's crazy. And she was like, did you say that? You know, or, you know, when we went to, we were involved with an organization called Johnny and Friends, which is a Christian disability organization. It's worldwide, actually, but they do these family retreats where you go away for a week. They have them all over the country. And
that's so cool.
And they have supported one-on-one care for your child. And it's like a family vacation. And, you know, mom and dad get to take a break and step back a little bit, and they take care of stuff. But, you know, even our kid, the first year we went, he was like, you know, six, and he was still a bundle of energy. And the woman that was his one-on-one was, you know, not a lot older, but, you know, middle age. And, you know, she was hurting a little bit. She had some kind of a back issue. And somebody she was talking to in like the common area in the main building where we were staying made some comment to her like, oh, geez, you know, I'm praying for you that you can, you know, keep up with Christopher this week and you have the energy to do that and all that. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, he just says, amen, God. And he's just like sitting there and they're like, what'd you say? You know, so he gets it. He gets it.
Yeah.
And we can go here now if you want, but there actually was, there was one very profound thing that happened this year, and it actually involved a bit of a medical crisis we had.
Let's do it.
And okay, so our son, essentially, his diagnosis is autistic, and he's functionally nonverbal. Other than some pretty bad ear.
How old is he?
11.
Okay.
Other than some pretty bad ear infections and that type of thing, and the cold fever kind of stuff, he never really had any serious medical stuff until this year. So one day in March, my wife calls me up. I'm at home. It was a Saturday. She calls me up and she says, listen, I need you to be ready because he was coming back from his ABA therapy and he threw up in the car. Can you just be ready to help clean him up? I said, sure. You know, it's not the weirdest thing. He throws up in the car, maybe he ate too much for lunch, whatever. I go to the car and I go to the back door to get him out. And it looks like he just had a stroke or something. His eyes rolled back in his head. He was drooling. Wow. He was unresponsive. It pulled him out of the car. He couldn't walk. And we're like, what is this? And we assumed it was a seizure. Now, he'd never had a seizure before.
Right.
So we weren't sure. Called the ambulance. The ambulance comes. And, you know, it was a little while before we actually got to the hospital. But on route to the hospital, he had two more seizures.
Whoa.
So we're freaking out. He's at the hospital. And he's hooked up to every tube and wire you could imagine. And we have no idea what's going on. So my wife stayed with him. And then I go home to, like, pack bags for us. Because we're like, we're going to be in the hospital for a little bit here, we figure. So, of course, I'm doing the totally safe thing. I'm texting and driving while I'm freaking out and crying and all this. And I'm letting everybody know what's going on. And, you know, think about us and pray for us and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden I get the text from my wife and she says, oh, they just did a scan on him and he has a Chiari. That's C-H-I-A-R-I, Chiari malformation. And I'm like, oh no, he's got a brain tumor. Like, I don't know what that is.
That's my first thought.
That sounds scary. So then, of course, I'm still driving and texting. So I punch it in Google and it says Chiari is basically where he has swelling on the back of the brain in terms of where, you know, the top of the spinal column, it's a swelling of brain mass or fluid, and it causes intense pressure on the brain, but it specifically impairs a lot of motor functions, gross motor functions. So of course, all of the issues that he's had over these years with, like, we've had to take him to vision therapy because things weren't processing right for him. You know, it affects the visual cortex. It affects a lot of his gross motor movements, you know, because his balance was always off. And in terms of, you know, his gait, how he walks and that type of thing. And now all of a sudden we're thinking, well, wait a minute. Maybe this explains some of that.
Yeah.
So it's very cool that we found this out. So he stayed in the hospital for 5 days. This was in March. And we talked to the neurosurgeon and the neurologist and they said, look, it's, you know, it's more common than you realize. It's like 1 in 300 people. And for the kind that he has, you know, it's not that serious. Like, we can do the surgery. It's still brain surgery, but we can do the surgery and it should be fine. So we said, okay. So a month later, we take him back to the hospital. Now we, of course, had prepped him for this. So going back to this whole nonverbal conversation, they made a social story for him in his special ed class. We talked to him. We talked to him on the iPad, all that. And this is a kid who was not easily fazed by anything, right? It was a Monday morning, 5 a.m. We get him to the hospital. And, you know, he's, you know, totally awake, whatever. And I'm walking him into the hospital. And he is absolutely terrified. He's shaking like a leaf. And I know that he knows what's up. He might not get all of it, but he knows enough to know this isn't good.
Yeah.
And all I could do was hold him and tell him, dude, it's going to be okay. Even though I didn't really know that, you know, that's all I could do. And I just held him and I kept holding him. And then, you know, you get him into the triage to get him prepped for surgery and they give him a little sedation and he calms down. And then, you know, we just kind of watch them, you know, wheel him off, you know, in the cart going into the operating room. And that was without question my toughest day as a parent because I didn't know it was going to be okay. And my kid is terrified. And I know he knows, look, something is really seriously intense going to happen here. And he didn't know if it was going to be okay. And truthfully, I didn't know if it was going to be okay.
No one,
and that's, that's the toughest thing as a parent, to have that level of surrender to say, you know, this, in my case, because of my faith, this is in God's hands. But again, I have no control over anything here. So yeah, he understood enough. He knew enough and he got it. And I think maybe if anything makes that, that moment harder, it's that, you know, that he knows, but then he really, you cannot have a verbal dialogue.
Yeah.
You can't work him through the fear or the anxiety or the stress. You just have to basically keep feeding into him positivity. We're here. It's going to be okay. You're not alone. We've got you. But, you know, that's a level of surrender that, you know, a lot of parents know and a lot of parents don't know. And it's not easy for anybody, for sure. Wow.
You know, I just can't imagine what you guys, you know, and especially Christopher, you know, going in there, and it's like you're like having still like these, and what I'm hearing from you is like this, you're just having nonverbal language with each other. It's like that, you know that, but I wonder if he knows that I know, and that I'm trying to tell you, buddy, that I'm like, I'm here for you. Like I want this to be, everything to be okay. Like, I just want to be there with you, but I can't, but I'm here and I can be. And so what ended up happening, right? Like he went into the, you know, he's getting carted away. And is it you and your wife in the waiting room? Anybody else with you?
Not at that time. We had some close family come a little bit later. So we were the ones who brought him to the hospital early. And then we got sent to a waiting room. And truthfully, it was pretty quick. It was only about less than 90 minutes.
Wow.
So it was, the surgeon didn't lie when he said that, yeah, this is going to be a pretty quick in and out.
Nice.
Type of a thing. And it went well, and the recovery was a little slow, and he had a little bed rest, and, you know, we had to just kind of keep him, you know, tucked away for, you know, for a few weeks.
Was he okay with
months.
Like with just laying there in bed rest? Like, was he able to, you know, sit there and actually, you know, do the healing process?
Well, yes, I would tell you we were in the hospital for about 4 or 5 days, and then we got home, and then it was probably about a weekish, maybe not even that, because one thing we know about him is that he's a fast healer.
Yeah.
He handles pain very well. I mean, like a couple of years before that, he actually got a splinter like about this big in his thumb, and we didn't know about it for a few days until like the whole thing swelled
wow.
up. he was going around like nothing's different. We're like, what
the
is
pain
that?
Tolerance.
You know, right. So we know he can handle a lot. He was definitely out of it for a little bit. The challenge was him wanting to do his regular activities and his routine and play the way he's used to and do all the sensory stuff. We're like, dude, you can't move.
Yeah.
Like let's keep yeah. it in bed. Let's keep it as still as possible. He loves being outside. We rented a wheelchair just so we could take him outside. And cause they said, don't even like put him in a car yet because
wow.
you don't want too much of that vibration stuff. And so we had to go from the wheelchair to the car, and then he could finally take a walk and that kind of thing. So, it was hard. It was hard for a while. And thankfully my wife got a medical leave from work from her teaching job. So, she got like the last couple months of school off. So she was really his like full-time person. So, you know, again, thank God for her and for our wonderful wives. And she stayed with him. And then like, you know, by the time summer hit, he was pretty much back to normal. So.
All right. And so we are back here having a really, really good conversation with John here about, you know, I mean, let's just kind of recap here. You know, we talked about how you have your hands in a lot of areas, you know, just as being that prominent male advocate for your son, Christopher. And, you know, you are a public speaker for the Key Ministry. You know, Hope and New, which I want to talk a little bit more about. I don't think we talked too much about that. We talked about your SOAR, where you just came back, and, you know, you told that remarkable story about how Christopher was able to, but he had that, you know, that big surgery, and that was a very tough moment for you guys as a family, where you really had to step out of your advocacy shoes and just kind of remain a bystander and sit back. I think one thing to do, you know, to get us back into the groove of the conversation is we talked about the shock factor. And, you know, when you learn about that initial diagnosis, there's that shock factor. And I want to know what that shock factor looks like. What is it, for one, you know, what are the characteristics of it visually? Like, you know, like, because when we think of shock, right, you know, we think of people just kind of, you know, sitting there and not doing anything. But also, you know, there's a lot of feeling that goes along with it. So can you give me, you know, what you're feeling exactly with that shock factor?
So I think it looks differently for different families. And I think it's also very specific to the diagnosis. You know, if you have a child who's born with Down syndrome, for example, you know, you know what that is, you know, from the day your child is born or maybe even before. And so, you know, that I think looks very different than a lot of folks who are dealing with kids with an autism diagnosis. I know in our case, it really wasn't a shock moment in the sense of, you know, one day we just got this diagnosis per se, boom. It was really a very slow road to really getting that our child was not the same as other kids. And I think in a couple of the other podcasts that you might have heard, I know I tell the story about when we went for his 18-month checkup and the pediatrician asked a battery of questions. And that's when we first knew something was wrong because she asked, is he speaking? And we're like, well, no, not really. We're getting a few sounds, but it's not really anything we would say is language. And, you know, her famous words were, well, you know, take him across the street to the professional building where the speech therapist is. Get him a session there. And her words exactly were, I don't know what they do, but they play with the kids and make them talk. So just go take them over there.
Yeah.
And even being teachers, you know, early childhood, you know, these early stages of development were not our thing. So we said, oh, okay, well, we don't know enough here, so let's do that. And then we go to the speech therapist, and the speech therapist said, no, I don't think it's, you know, it's not anything I can address. You know, maybe get his hearing tested. We get the hearing tested. No, the hearing is fine. Get him into early intervention. We started getting some services that way. It really wasn't until he was, you know, we got the initial diagnosis of PDD, NOS, pervasive developmental disorder.
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually that just became straight autism under the autism umbrella. You know, we didn't get that diagnosis until he was just about 3. So, you know, by then we really came to terms with the fact that, okay, this is where we're at. But we still had hope. We still had hope for our child.
Yeah.
And we still did all the therapies and all of the different protocols and diets and specialists and all of these things. And some work better than others. And some parents swear by some things. And you know, something that might work for your child doesn't work for someone else and vice versa. So one of the things that happens with this diagnosis is sometimes you get that initial shock and then you kind of have to recover from that. In our case, and in the case I think of a lot of autistic families we know, is that it's that really slow grind. It's that, okay, we think he has this or she has this, and then we kind of know, and then we try to work with it. And then as the years go by, we hope that some things will get better, and maybe they don't. And you really need a lot of fortitude, and you need just a lot of heart, and you really need to have a good center to keep yourself steady, because you have to slowly come to the realization of what your child can do and can't do, or may be able to do with their lives or maybe not. And the unfortunate thing is this. I think that as hard as it might be to get that initial shock of, okay, your child has this, boom, now what? In some ways that is maybe a little bit more merciful than the grind, because with the grind, every day you think, will today be the day that maybe something happens?
Yeah.
Is today the day that something changes? You know, what's going to happen after this therapy session and all that? And that can wear on you. And that can get you to a point where slowly, you know, if you're not careful, you will lose hope quickly. And that's how a lot of families really do fall apart.
So how can you give advice to people that, like, are hoping for something? Like they're like, oh, okay, you know, this is just a phase, or this is just something that's going on, or like, I'm just looking for something that I'm not getting from my child. And maybe you think that they're looking in the wrong places.
Well, here's what I would say. And again, this is a very hard question to answer, and I've got the utmost, you know, empathy for anyone who's facing this. You know, wherever your child is at, you have to remember that that's still your child, and find the happiness and the joy and the hope in what they are, regardless of anything else. Expectations will kill you. Expectations will kill you as a parent. It will kill your relationship with your child. It'll kill your marriage, all of it. You've got to let the expectations go, put them on the table, put them aside, and say, okay, let's redefine this for our family, for our kid. Because even as you have to redefine it from a typical family, even special needs families are different in terms of different diagnoses and different situations in terms of school, environment, conditions, whatever plays out there. You've got to put it all aside and say, you know what, this is what works for our family. And that's tough to figure out, especially when you've got so many moving pieces. But that's also where I kind of, you know, segue into the way that I always like to answer these questions is, you know, kind of my 1A and then 1B formula. If you ask me in any circumstance, my 1A answer to the question is, where do you kind of find your hope? And for me, it's my faith. Now, I was raised, you know, Catholic on the north side of Chicago. My wife was raised Jewish on the North Shore. When we got married, we weren't very religious people. You know, I think we were kind of, you know, however you want to describe it, secularly spiritual or whatever. You know, we believed in God, but we weren't going to belong to a church or a temple or whatever. And really, it was our child's disability that brought us to faith, and specifically me, because the 1B part of that conversation is community. You can't do this alone. As much as you want to set up your four walls and as much as you want to keep the world out and not tell anybody that you've got this going on, eventually you have to. And how are you going to engage that? You can't do this alone. You need community. If you're not a religious person, if faith isn't your thing and talking about God, okay, fine. If you are a religious person, you know that community goes hand in hand with that. But if you're not, you still need community. You still need people to support you. You still need people to speak into your lives, because you will not get very far. You know, you need to find those other, specifically those special needs families that get you. You, of course, need, you know, typical friends and families with typical kids too. You know, I think you need all of it, but you need those people who specifically get you and will walk beside you. And that's also where I've been very grateful to work with a lot of the organizations that I do, because of the level of advocacy that they provide, whether it's for special needs dads or for families in a variety of different ways. There's tons of resources out there, and some things might be for you and some things not, but there is something for you out there. And if you're going to do nothing else, find a way to connect with people, find what works for you in terms of that format, and just develop that relationship. Even if it's one or two good friends, that in and of itself will probably be enough to push you down the road and really help to save you when the really hard times come.
You know, there's so many parts that I want to get to, that, you know, I really love your 1A and 1B. But also I want to first talk about that, you know, speech therapist, the you have a really good one now, and I'm really excited about that. Or like you've had, you know, I think you alluded to that right at the beginning, right?
Yeah, and she's actually not a speech therapist. She's actually a physical therapist that actually kind of works out of the box and does a whole variety of stuff.
And those are the people we need.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you know, so that's one end of the spectrum. And let's go down to what, you know, your son's 18 months. You're the most vulnerable you've ever been, or at least, you know, to my knowledge of our conversation, our experience here, and you know, as a couple, you're vulnerable and you're just, you know, your wife's looking for that affirmation of that research. You know, she's heard some terms about early intervention, or maybe she's looked into it a lot. And all of a sudden says, why don't you go across the street there? And they'll go just play with your child and they'll begin to talk. That's, you know, that kills me to hear something like that, because that's not what happens. And it's not as easy as that. And it's just like, almost gives you guys a sense of not false hope, but like, okay, maybe this will work, you know? And it's just like, it's not really properly guiding you. And that's why I'm really happy that where we are today in society, and, you know, especially in the autism community and the people with disability communities, that there are a range of sources. And I really want to caution people, that not everything that you hear is true, and that you can have this similar experience online. Like, some people go on to these big parent groups, and they're people are giving advice out that don't have the credentials to, like, you know, in terms of like what interventions to give your child when they're, you know, doing self-harm, self-injurious behaviors, you know. Okay, you know, it's important to listen to the people that know what they're doing, because people who are looking and seeking that advice are vulnerable. Can you give me, you know, and I want to talk about the 1A and 1B in a bit, but can you talk to me about how vulnerable you were from, like, those zero to where, okay, you know, I mean, to 18 months there, you know, like the 0 to 5, 0 to 6, right? He's kind of growing up like he's a typical baby, right? You know, you're comparing other babies with other babies, and like, yay, you know, we're all babies and parents and we're having fun. And then their kids start to chirp a little bit, and your son's kind of, well, yeah, he'll get there. He's just a little late bloomer, right? And then you get up to the 18th month mark, and he's still not talking, and all of a sudden, yeah, go across the street and play. And they'll teach him how to talk. Can you talk to me about those moments of vulnerability as a father and a husband right there?
Well, I think for me, and this is probably pretty typical of most parents, most families, and you know, how they would respond. But, you know, I'll go back to that point about expectations. As a parent, you have all the wonderful expectations in the world for your kid, that your kid's going to be just fine. And whatever goes on with anybody else's kids, whatever, you know, these stories or these statistics you hear, well, that's just not going to happen to us. And there's a tremendous amount, for myself at least, I'm going to call it guilt, because you feel like there's something you should have done differently. There's something you should have fixed, or there's something that there was a different approach you should have taken. And the problem is that when some of these things start to not look right, I know conversations we had with friends we had. Now, some of these were parents and some weren't. And the parents that we were friends with at the time, one really tricky devil here was that we had no friends that had special needs kids. So the barometer is, okay, well, this is normal, and now we're not sure about this. Now, on the one hand, you might think, well, then that's probably pretty easy to tell, but the issue is that you don't really know how much of an issue something is until you actually have to go talk to a professional or a specialist.
Yeah.
So in our case, we said, look, these things are happening, and then all of a sudden it's a head-scratcher, like, well, why would these things be happening? Well, what are you guys doing? Well, you did everything right. What's the problem? And then you do all of that critical self-examination of, did we do this right? Did we do this enough? Was this a problem? Was that? And it's the easiest thing in the world to pick on this, that, or the other, because now as many answers as you can get, especially with autism, you can never really identify that one thing to say, okay, well, it, you know, this is a result of this. You know, maybe if we had done more in utero care, or maybe if, you know, we hadn't, you know, done this approach when he was 6 months old or something, yeah, or whatever, that might have fixed it. So you become really critical, self-critical, and then within the marriage, in terms of your different roles as parents, you become critical, like, okay, well, what did you do? Did you do something different than I did? And what are you doing? And let's make sure we're doing the same thing so that we're consistent and whatnot. And so everything gets scrutinized. And that's a lot of pressure on a young family.
Those are very real conversations.
On young parents, you know. So that's where that goes to. And so that's where it's important to have perspective and take a step back and not beat yourself up. But then also where that support factor comes in, because then you have folks who, first of all, care enough about you to remind you that you're a good person still, you're a good parent, but right now you have something, you know, on the table that you may not know how to handle. So that's where you need that support to kind of come around you and then kind of help you to navigate it. Ultimately, no one can ever, you know, make the decisions for you as a parent. And I know for myself, whenever I give advice, I say, listen, I can't tell you what to do for your kid. I would never do that. I can give you my opinion. I can tell you my experience. I can support you in your decision. But ultimately, you know, that is something that will lead you down a spirally death really quick, is the criticism, the self-criticism, and eventually how that plays out in a relationship and in a marriage, and ultimately leads to, you know, some pretty tragic stuff.
So did you find yourself, and despite that example, that therapist in the very beginning, around the 18 months, did you find yourself taking inappropriate advice from people just because, like, you're grasping for air, or you're just really searching for something, or just that right method? Like, have you found, like, you ran into people where they're like, I totally should have asked them that, or they just totally gave me the wrong advice, or I took it because I was so vulnerable?
So I would tell you, we've looked at pretty much everything. I wouldn't say that there was anything we did that we felt bad about later.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can go here, and I'm sure a lot of people have opinions about this. You know, the vaccination thing always comes up, and I'll be transparent about that. You know, our child was fully vaccinated up to the age of 4. And then we stopped, because, you know, we just felt that it wasn't in his best interest. And we do have a religious exemption, and that's not just because we don't feel like it. I mean, that is true for us.
Yeah.
You know, I would never tell another parent to not do that.
Right.
I would never tell another parent, you know, that, you know, just stop doing that, because that's what caused this, that, or the other. That was something that took us a long time to get to. You know, if anybody asks me why you made that choice, you know, I can certainly share my opinions about it. But again, I'm very careful with that, because at the end of the day, I don't know what caused anything. So I'm not the expert. I base it on the information I get. You know, I'm not going to say that anything is truly bad information. I think all information has value, but you need to understand the application of it too. You know, good information can be used to lead you down the wrong path as well. You know, and there's a lot of bad information out there as well, especially with the internet. So, you know, what I say is that, you know, I believe that parents need to make the right decisions for themselves. That's going to look different for everybody. You know, I would never tell a parent to do or not do something. I would say explore things, but you probably, again, this is where also your community can help you, because then you have people that you can trust. If you put something in a group on Facebook, you know, you're going to get people who will tell you all kinds of things. And the other problem is that you will also get people who will be, if they feel like it, will be very critical of you, or if they don't believe in something you did or didn't do, they may call you a bunch of bad names. Well, okay, you know what? We have to remember how to respectfully disagree in this country, which is something I've lost. That's a whole other, you know, segue we don't have to go into.
Yeah.
But again, it's a matter of respecting people's boundaries as parents, and special needs parents are already going through so much. They don't need that level of criticism or judgment. They need help. They need support. Come around them and legitimately support them and give them what they need. If you don't have an answer, fine. But support them in whatever decision they make as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced that Facebook and all that, it's actually an algorithm just for rage, where, you know, people are, you know, I mean, and there is a really good community. There are good communities on there, and there are good information, and there's just, you know, you need to understand the way to access it and find it. And, you know, I don't even find myself posting opinions. I mean, my only opinions you're going to see are just what I think is, you know, oh, I think this is a lovely video, or this video talks a lot about advocacy, or I think this video is hilarious, or I think that this video is really cool. You know, just because what you perceive and what you define as what you think is best is important and true to yourself. And we're not here to let anybody get their, you know, to get their two cents in there. You know, I don't need to know what someone in New Jersey thinks about my views on whatever, you know what I'm saying? So it's, you know, I think I can relate to you in that sense, is that what you think you are doing is right, and, you know, you have the best intentions, and you have a community that supports you, so, and that makes you happy. And I think what things that make you happy and things that make other, you know, your close one happy is a really important to do. You know, I really like, again, I want to talk about the communities, and, you know, your 1A and 1B, And I mentioned several times on my podcast earlier that it's important just to have, you know, it's important to have multiple voices that really do come into that one voice. And here, the special thing about having you again is that you are a father advocate, and that you go above and beyond and you help other fathers advocate and get the strength and all that. When I'm listening to some of your stuff in other podcasts, I hear the word brotherhood. And, you know, you talk about, I want to kind of start here just because I think that people need to relate to this and they need to understand it's that, you know, having somebody with disability can really impact your marriage a lot, where things could be very perfect one day and then all of a sudden arguments are making you look at your spouse a whole different way. And they're also making yourself look at yourself a whole different way. So, you know, we talked about like kind of how he was up at that 18 months there, but we didn't talk about you in particular, you know, in terms of how you were feeling. And I want you to kind of guide us to where and how you got to up to that brotherhood term right now, because I think our terms, our definitions of brotherhood are synonymous. So talk to me about those points in your life that, you know, you're really looking at your marriage and you're looking at your son and you're looking at yourself. What were those points where you really noticed a change in how you're thinking and feeling?
So I'll go to when everything kind of fell apart, because I think that'll really speak the best to this. By the end of 2011, things started to come apart in the sense that, you know, we always had a lot of stress under the surface, as most special needs families do.
Can you define that a little bit more?
So stress in the sense of, you know, first of all, financial. And I talked a little bit about, you know, being the breadwinner or not being the breadwinner kind of a thing in terms of those roles. And, you know, luckily through my wife's school district, we always had very good insurance that covered a lot, but it didn't cover everything.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for help from family, specifically my mother-in-law, we wouldn't be able to cover a lot of those things. But it's stress for the family, and then it's stress for myself because I'm the one who always feels like I need to be taking care of that. As a special needs parent also too, self-care becomes a big deal. When you are not taking care of yourself, when you're not doing the things that fill you up, getting enough sleep, exercise, you know, time out with friends, whatever, that's going to wear on you. And then it's going to wear on the marriage because then you get all the infighting and it's a lot of this isn't fair, that isn't fair. You get to do this and I don't get to do this. There was also a lot of what I would really call, at least my experience, some judgment and some, you know, just some negativity that started to creep in from the friends we did have, who again, none of them were special needs parents. And in some ways they could be critical of specifically me, in terms of maybe feeling like I wasn't doing enough kind of a thing. And all that started to wear. And then at the end of 2011, I took a hit at the school that I was working at, and I was laid off and I was let go. And then, of course, the finances really went into a spiral. And then, of course, everything else started to go into a spiral. And then it became pretty clear that very quickly there was a chasm that kind of opened up. And it was really me on one side, my wife, my son, my mother-in-law on the other. And it really became almost a conversation of survival, where my wife really began to say it might be best if we separate because this isn't working. We have all this going on. I had an awareness and, you know, we've kind of moved past this. So it's not like I need to know at this point, but I had an awareness that a lot of the friends we did have, specifically the women, a lot of those couples were actually, interestingly enough, going through marital issues. Some of them, you know, were getting divorced or in the process of divorce. Some of them had already separated. So there was a lot of that in the environment. There wasn't a lot of support, true support, positivity, feeding us in.
Everyone's going through their own stuff.
Right, exactly. And it was easy to point fingers, you know, on everybody's side. So what it came down to was, I started to reach out, you know, for help. And I would ask, you know, some of my, you know, close friends. I talked to my close friend from high school. I talked to some close friends from college. All of them really kind of said, man, I don't know what to tell you. You know, in fact, I had one of my best friends even tell me, I think it's best that you leave because some of this doesn't really sound fair to you. And I said, I can't do that. I can't leave my family. But I get what you're saying. And he's like, well, just make sure you're taking care of yourself. Now, what was interesting is that there was one person that was really supportive of our family and specifically my wife in a positive way that she worked with at her school. She was a Christian. She had just gotten married. And, you know, she was really kind of, she was just always there for my wife. You know, she was always kind of asking her how she was doing, you know, like they'd eat lunch together and they just talk about life. And one day my wife just asked her out of the blue, hey, you know, does your church have like a men's group? Because, you know, I think I'm pretty good as far as like what's going on. Like I'm not the issue, but he is. And he probably could use some guys to talk to that would be healthy.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm like, man, I'll go talk to anybody you want. That's cool.
Yeah.
So I go to this Bible study. And again, I was raised Catholic, but, you know, I hadn't been religious for a while kind of a thing. But, you know, whatever. I had no problem. And I go to this thing and I'm at this Bible study with these guys. And I don't know anybody, you know. But the crazy thing is that those strangers in that room, they were interested in me. They asked questions about what was going on. They asked how they could help me. How can we support you? What can we do? They even, when they realized that, because we were also in the process of selling our house because we were lucky enough with help from the family that we could sell our house. We lived in Grays Lake at the time. We were moving to Northbrook, you know, but our house was still like a short sale. So, you know, we were having to pack the house up, get it ready to sell. They were like, look, can we help you move? Can we help you pack up? What can we do? And I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Huh.
And here was the thing, you know, so on the one hand, you know, for me, you know, my faith journey begins there because that's when I became a Christian, when I had that experience, you know. And so for guys who want to talk about where your faith comes from or how it started, that's how it started for me. Because I had guys intentionally and consciously who didn't know me from anybody still say, you know what, you're worth it. You know, you're worth it. You're a good guy. You're not broken. You know, you just need help. You're going through some hard times, and that's fine. We all go through them in our own way, whatever that looks like. And so I had that piece, but then I also started to learn that, okay, you know, this was about community. This was about intentionally being fed into and then feeding into other people. So that's really what saved me. It was out of everything that was going on, you know, and friends that were going through maybe similar stuff in terms of their marriages falling apart and not having a lot of support individually and then also as a couple, you know, all of a sudden here was this group of total strangers that said, yeah, you know what, we'll come alongside you. And none of them were special needs dads either, but they understood.
That blows my mind.
You know, yeah. And I mean, you know, I speak to it from that faith perspective and connection. You know, for me that very much was a God thing. But again, even if you're not coming at this from a religious perspective and you say that that's not me, understand that if it wasn't for those guys being the vehicle, nothing else would have happened for me because I was at the end of my rope, quite honestly. And I have no problem being transparent about this either, that it was just maybe a couple months earlier that things had gotten so bad that I sat down one day in front of my computer and I wrote three letters. And I talk about this in the other podcast. I wrote a letter to my wife, my son, and my mother. All three of them were suicide notes.
Oh, man.
And I never tried anything. It never got that far. I wrote the letters. But I felt like there was no other way out. And all it took was for me to go to a Bible study with a group of guys I never met before to shift it enough. And everything, it wasn't a total change. It's not like my life got miraculously saved the next day. It was still hard. There were still bad days. There was still work. But what it meant is that, you know, my wife saw that I was different because now I was getting fed positivity. I was getting fed something that on a spiritual level then helped to manifest physical changes in me where I started feeling better about myself and interacting in the family. And ultimately it was me coming to the realization of, I don't know how this is going to work out. It's like my son going to the operating room. I don't know how this is going to work out, but I'm going to trust it is. And I'm going to keep moving forward one step at a time, day by day. And you know what? I got there. And so because of that, this is really intentional for me to give back to other guys wherever they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do a support group for guys in Northbrook. You know, not all of them are religious and whatever. In fact, the guy that I started with, is you know, he's culturally Jewish, but he's essentially an atheist. And you know what? That's fine. You know what? Yeah. It's not up to me to tell him what to believe. I have no problem sharing with him what I believe, but at the same time, he supports dads the way that I support dads, and that's what we have in common, and that's our mission. So I will get on board with anybody who has that mission, whoever you are, wherever you come from, but it's about saving marriages, it's about saving families. In my case, it's about saving lives, because yeah. literally my life was saved, and I have no problem with, you know, putting in that perspective.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And like, I mean, I don't think, you know, it really does take, you know, a man, and I'm going to kind of contradict what I'm saying in a second, a man to really admit that, you know, but when we look at the pressures of what we are to this day of being a man, and what is that, you know, you got to be, you know, wear your emotions, or, you don't wear your emotions on your sleeves, you know, you walk around, you get big muscles, but I don't think what people understand is, you know, part of being a man is also working on yourself, right? Like working on yourself. And this is something that you brought up. And if you can't work on yourself, then what kind of man are you? That's my definition of a man, is that, you know, somebody who's able to be, you know, the range of everything, right? You have your, you know, you're sensitive, but, also you have that strength, but you also have that vulnerability, but you also have that ability to bring people together. And note that I didn't have anything in there about physical strength or wearing the right clothes or whatever. You know, I think being a man is very different to everybody. But I think that the concepts that you have of within that men's group, that men's support group, everybody really has that same common thing where it's like, well, you're an atheist, you're Jewish, I'm Catholic. But we also have this issue here that we need to come together and use our strength to solve that problem. You know, I really wonder how many people out there kind of had those same thoughts as you, and they just really can't reiterate it. And again, that really brings a lot of light out of you and all that. And to let everybody know that they're not alone, and not taking this the wrong way, but it's okay to feel like that. It's okay to feel that you are lost, and you just need to find that voice. You need to find that community. You need to advocate. You know, you're so busy advocating for Christopher that you've lost yourself, or advocating for. I mean, let's find your words of advocacy. Then, like, did you even know how to advocate at that moment? I feel like right now you got it locked down, you know, but you're still learning, right? And I'm not sitting here as the professor of all this or whatever, you know, this is just what I'm gathering from you, dude. And I'm freaking inspired. But I mean, like, it seems like you were lost for advocacy there. You didn't know what to advocate for or what to do or anything like that. And finding that group, what does that, you know, that brotherhood still do to you for this day?
So, And you know what, as I really sit with it, you know, it's kind of a real emotional anchor for me, because I go back to that first night I went to that, or, you know, those early days, weeks kind of a thing. It's kind of that place in your memory that you go to when you need to go to that happy, safe space when you're really having a bad day. And it's like, you just need that one memory maybe to just kind of wrap around you and give you that hug or whatever.
Yeah.
It very much is that. I learned so much from those guys, and I learned a lot from other guys too along the way, for sure. But what I go back to is that, you don't know the impact you're going to have on somebody. You know, you really don't. You know, this interview may save somebody's life. I don't know. I don't want to assume that or think that, you know, this is the greatest thing ever or whatever, sure, you know. But I mean, the fact is, like, you know, it's the actions that I'm taking, that you're taking, that other intentional men and women out there are taking to support others. So, you know, I like to believe that whatever I write or I do on a podcast or speak, or any of the people that I know, for example, you know, you never know the impact it will have. And you can't assume that it's going to save everybody. But at the same time, you also can't assume that it's not going to help somebody.
Right.
And if it, like I said, if it helps one person, then it's worth it for me, because I know what it was to not have anybody in my corner. I know what it was to wake up in mornings in my home with my family as if they weren't even there. You know, days when my wife, and this was my experience, and it might not have been her intention, and maybe she really didn't feel this way, but my experience of those days were, do you even care if I live or die? Like if I got in the car and I didn't come home, would it matter? You know, I mean, those are the places I went to. So to know that somebody is willing to just sit and listen to you and care enough to say, you know, man, I'm sorry, you know, and again, I may not have an answer for you, but I'm here. I'll listen. What do you need? Do you just need someone to talk to? Do you just need somebody to, you know, give you a hug or you know, pat you on the back or something, or take you out for a coffee or a beer or whatever? Yeah. You know, you need people. You need community. You cannot do this alone. And that's really what I stress, is that that is the one commonality we can all find with the level of stress and crisis that we find ourselves in, is wherever you're at, whatever you believe or don't believe, or wherever you are on this journey, you can't do it alone. Get some support, get some mentorship, get help. If you're listening to this and you're like, yeah, I want to talk to that dude, then fine. You know, you can email me or shoot me a message or whatever. If it's something else that, you know, maybe, you know, I talk about on here or something else you find, awesome. But get someone, because you know what, that can make all the difference.
Yeah. I think even, you know, again, and going back to where people are kind of scared to ask for help, and like, you know, because we're supposed to be a man and we're supposed to be this tough person, supposed to take on and be the breadwinner, pay all the bills, do all that. People really don't understand the great, like, you know, just how I'm going to admit here, you know, I saw somebody, you know, a psychologist back in when I was in high school, and it was like the most important thing for me, because it gave me so much self-strength, and I couldn't do it on my own. And like, I just was like, you know, wondering and searching for my purpose and really overanalyzing the things that I'm doing to deteriorate my own self. And like, I just was too scared to talk to anybody, because I just thought I can handle it on my own. And that's not the case. And you know, even to this day, that, you know, I still would love to go see my guy, you know, and go say hi to him. And because I just remember, you know, do you ever have that feeling of that when you talk to somebody and you get it all off your mind, it's almost like steam just kind of comes out of your head and you walk out with a nice little smile, you know, and you just kind of, then you get in your car and you're going home and you're like, all right, that was good. You know, that was cool. And I think that's the feeling we need. Have you ever felt that before?
Yeah, no, for sure. And you know what, that's the experience of, you know, release, of that good emotional release, and being able to just be in the presence of someone who just wants to hear you without expectation. You know, that's the other thing. You know, it's great to talk to somebody when, you know, when you begin that interaction, you know, you're not trying to impress somebody or, you know, worried about how something comes out. It's like, hey, listen, just talk, just talk, and we'll see where it goes, and whatever. And that's big, because the other thing too, is that when you go through stuff on this level, you also very quickly feel like there's no one who will listen, no one who cares, no one who, you know, wants to even give you the time of day kind of thing. And sometimes just being able to spill your guts to somebody, because again, the things that we go through are very unique and specific to us. Each family is very different in its own way. But there are a lot of things that we have commonalities with, you know, in terms of just our kids and behaviors and, you know, some things that, you know, they're still learning to do regardless of age or whatever it is, you know, stuff that, you know, to other people, they'd be like, what are you talking about? You kind of a thing, because you don't have a framework for it. And so that's the other thing too, as you grow as a parent, as your child grows, as your child gets older and you get older, these things also start to look vastly different than your friends with typical kids. So that's a whole other conversation. So it's not just, well, my kid plays a little differently with the toys at the preschool. It's, You know, my kid is now, you know, doing away trips to camp, or, you know, they're doing all these projects at school, whatever. And, you know, my kid, you know, we're still working on some basic, you know, functional stuff. And you know what? That's okay too, because, you know, if he gets some of that, awesome. And if he doesn't, hey, you know what, we'll still live with it and we'll still love him. So.
Dude, that is the freaking gold mine right there, man. That is a perspective where, you know, that we need to have. And it's not a, lack for better words, not a pissing match here, you know. Yeah. And it's and some people like to take it like that. And again, if you go back to my example from Peru, we're all the same person, you know. Like, I mean, we are the same embodiment, right? You know, but yet we're so diverse, and it's important to appreciate that. And when you can't appreciate that, your mind is way too narrow, and you know, you're not going to really do too much good for people who really need the support. And so, John, I think what I'm learning from you today, and what I know I'm learning from you today, is vulnerability. I think that's one of the, like, I love this, because I'm taking this stuff away too. And like, being vulnerable, we know, is important, right? Being vulnerable to the wrong people, we know, is not right. And that can lead you down to a wrong way. Being vulnerable to yourself can be dangerous, but with the help of people who have a common interest and a common knowledge, we can see effective self-treatment and effective conversations and discussions that need to be happened in order to really, for people to understand us, because we are looking for people to understand us, right? Like, I feel like your wife understood you throughout your whole life, and then, you know, you had this experience. You had your son, and to the point where you're like, she's on track, I'm not, and here's the point where she doesn't understand me, and maybe that's why I'm off track. And like, well, maybe I need to go to somebody else to help work on me. You know, there's a really good book out there, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, very big classic one.
Yeah.
And I take that perspective of, are you going to perform, you know, are you going to perform maintenance on your own motorcycle and ask other people for help? Or are you going to make somebody else do it and you're going to go pick it up in a few days? That work is something that's really important. And I want to go reread that book now. Just thinking about it. I love it. I'm not a big reader. You know, that's what I'm learning from you today, John. And I'm like really appreciative of that, is that vulnerability, and that we're not like, you know, we truly aren't in this alone. And I think that we like to make people think that we are, so that they can maybe hear us. You know, I compare myself to being a baby sometimes, you know, like, oh, I'll make a situation seem a little bit bigger because I'm trying to complain and see people, you know, like, are they really listening, or, you know, but I think it's just really stepping up and being that man and saying, I need help, right? We teach our kids to do that, ask for help. You know, I'm sure Christopher is being taught that in school, ask for help. But yet, as somebody who has an advocacy podcast, I find it troublesome, or, you know, difficult sometimes to ask for help. And it's okay. You know, it's okay to be vulnerable to somebody else who will be on the same team as you, right?
Yeah, no, and it's interesting you bring up help, because one of the women that I spoke with on the parents panel this past week, her big thing is help. And the point that she made, which I thought was extremely it was extremely real for me, was the fact that it's not just a question of asking for help. You know, we need to be vulnerable and we need to ask for help. We also need to know what to ask for.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times what happens is, and she spoke to it, and I agree, is that, you know, people will sometimes even offer and say, hey, look, I'd love to help you. Or I see that you're going through a lot, or, you know, wow, you got a lot on your plate. How can I help? And a lot of times it's, you're so frustrated or overwhelmed, you don't even know what to
ask
for.
Like, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. Right. Even happens with people in death, right? Like, when they're like, oh, you know, I know you've been hearing this from everybody, but let me know if there's anything I can do, you know? And it's like, that's not the right question, right? Or that's not the right statement. And I think that's what you're going at, right?
Yeah, it's really about being open to the help, and then also being very intentional and saying, okay, I really could use help with this, for example. Like maybe there's something that specifically is something in your house or in your family that you're really struggling with. Like, you know what? I really need an extra couple hours to go grocery shopping. Would you mind hanging out with my kid? If that's something that's possible or not, I don't know. Would you mind picking up some things for me? Or would you mind, you know, running an errand or, you know, even just being in the house with me and just kind of talking to me while I, you know, go through some routines or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's that intentionality of, okay, where am I weak? You know, what are the things that are not working and where can people legitimately help? And again, see, that's tricky too, because you have to be vulnerable enough to admit you need help, but then you also have to really know where those weak spots are and, okay, you know what? This really isn't working. Not only do I need help, I could really use some help here.
Yeah, but do you think people might shy away from that too? Like, because sometimes I'll be, you know, fearful of asking for help because I'm like, oh, I don't want to inconvenience them. You know, like I don't want to. Oh, you know, they're busy all the time, and like, asking them to go out for, help me out for 3 hours while I go grocery shopping. I mean, that's a lot of time, and you know, I don't want to be a burden. You know, I feel like that's sometimes what could prevent me, right? Like. But it's like, you know, how do you get over that? How do you get, like, you know, okay with asking somebody and not worrying about burdening them because you know that they'll do it for you, right? You know?
Yeah, and again, I think that goes back to you doing the work on yourself to get, okay, listen, this is hard. I'm struggling and I can't do this by myself because... You know, what you're really doing is on the one hand, you want to make sure that you have your and the metaphor I like to use is the four walls, right? You want to have your four walls around you so that you're guarded from negativity and from folks whose judgment or perceptions of you would harm you or harm your family. At the same time, though, you need to also be willing to let people in. You need to be willing to open up and receive. You know, there's a great analogy. There's a financial expert guy, Dave Ramsey. He's a Christian financial expert. And he has this great metaphor he uses in his talks, which is he takes a dollar bill and he sticks it into his hand and he closes the fist. Now, the intention here is, okay, look, you understand that if you hold on to your money this tightly, you're not going to lose it. It's not going to fall out. But guess what else? Nothing else can get in.
Yeah.
You've got to be willing to allow for that flow. You got to be willing to say, you know what? Maybe I will lose this dollar, but maybe another 10 will fall right back in its place. So you want to be open to those people that you know legitimately do care for you and say, you know what? I got to be honest with you. I'm having a really tough time here. Are you willing to talk? Are you willing to listen? Are you willing to help out? Whatever that is. So you have to be guarded, but you have to be guarded in a very intentional way and not push people out that really mean good for you and are well-intended and can legitimately help you in the places you need.
Yeah. I think that's some extremely solid advice there. It's that really ask and find out what you need that help for and don't be afraid to. It's just kind of like repetition, right? You know, and this is just kind of me speaking out loud. What I had to do is that just like be okay with that. Be okay with asking for, you know, I put it in perspective in my classroom. You know, I used to take on a lot more of the work than I should have. And it was kind of getting me in, you know, a little bit of trouble because I was leaving my classroom so much to do things, you know, and just got to know that, you know, asking people, it really does alleviate the pressure off of you to like set up to some standard that you have in your head of yourself that I don't think we're ever going to meet. You know, I don't know if you can agree with me here. Like, I don't know. I have the standard for myself and I feel like that I'm just about to reach it. And then all of a sudden I just move it up to a whole another thing. And I don't think I'm ever going to hit it. I don't think I'm ever going to, and I don't ever think I'm doing a good enough job with anything and all that. And I'm like consciously trying to tell myself like, you gotta be okay with that. Like, you know, like you're just being competitive with yourself and all that, and that's okay. But like 2 weeks ago, I'll think that I'm like, oh yeah, silly, you know, but right now in that moment, it really stresses me out. You know what I'm saying? And like, I'm telling myself, hey, like, no, you're fine. You're fine. In 2 weeks, there'll be nothing, you know? Well, just think about 2 weeks ago. But it's just so hard in that moment. And I think things to help relieve me is to just know what to ask for.
Yeah, and that type of companion.
All right, so as you can see here, we've gotten to that point right now where it is actually very hard to hear the audio. So just for the sake of your ears and just for the sake of all those lovely listeners out there, go ahead and check out John Fellegeller. He is on several social media outlets, and all of that will be posted below. So please make sure that you, I need you to subscribe. I need you to follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, all that stuff. And you're going to be able to see the great information that John was able to bring to us. We just really kind of wrapped up the conversation talking about, you know, how he has bought a motorhome. And that has been a nice little outlet for his son to use in order to be able to get out of the house and to be able to enjoy the things that he wants to enjoy. And in turn, that's really made John happy. So once again, I apologize. And I promise it's going to get... Well, the videos will be much better after this. So thank you, and I appreciate it, and I hope you have a great day.